This is a podcast from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research institute that explores budget policies and issues affecting low and moderate income Americans. I'm Michelle Bazzi. Welcome to this policy briefing.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Bob Greenstein. I and our whole team of analysts here at the center have been looking at the budget today. Just within the past 10 minutes or so, we have posted a statement that's actually a short analysis in the form of a statement. It's about a four-page analysis on our website. I'm going to briefly go through here some of what are our main observations and analytic conclusions based on the budget, and then we'll go to questions. And with me here when we get to the questions is Jim Horney, Director of Federal Fiscal Policy at the Center, former longstanding senior CBO official and one of Washington's leading budget experts. As we look at this budget, given both the economic and the political context, I think we end up concluding that this is a pretty solid budget given the bounds of the possible. I'll explain in a minute more what I mean by that. There obviously are three needs here. There's the need to deal with the short-term problems the economy faces. There's the need to deal with the longer-term and medium-term priority of bringing deficits under control. There also is a need for policy improvements in some important areas. Now, in the first of these, the problems facing the economy, the budget actually proposes about $266 billion in boosts to the economy. Some early reports that it included a $100 billion short-term boost actually were off the mark. There is a provision in the budget for a $100 billion jobs initiative, but there is an additional $166 billion primarily in extending some current temporary provisions, which are very important to shore up the economy and which are slated to expire, principally unemployment insurance benefits, state fiscal relief, the Making Work Pay tax credit, and several smaller items. Prior to today, many people, including ourselves, were concerned that given the widespread forecasts by economic forecasters that economic growth is likely to slow later in the year as the effects of the stimulus wear off, and that there is a not insignificant risk of a double dip to the recession, which could be quite devastating. There were concerns that policymakers wouldn't do enough on the short-term temporary front to boost the economy. About 10 days ago, Mark Zandi of MoodysEconomy.com called for $250 billion in more short-term boosts, and that's pretty much exactly what the budget does. On the medium and long-term deficit reduction front, on the one hand, the budget would reduce deficits by about $1.25 trillion over the next 10 years compared to what they would be if we simply continued all current policies without changing them. So that's a positive step, a significant step. Obviously, it falls well short of what will be needed to get deficits under control. So there's a case for more medium and long-term deficits, strong case for more medium and long-term deficit reduction than the budget contains. Having said that, my conclusion is that the budget probably goes as far in that area as today's toxic political environment will allow, even if the president pushes quite forcefully for his budget proposals. Many of the proposals in this budget that would provide some fiscal restraint, from closing unproductive tax loopholes to scaling back farm subsidies for wealthy farmers, are going to face rough sledding on Capitol Hill. They may prove to be beyond what a polarized Congress facing continuous roadblocks and filibusters and with an election in mind will produce this year. Let me give some examples of some of the hard hard choices that are in the budget and whose fate is uncertain. So the budget proposes to save $750 billion over 10 years through three significant steps on the tax side. It would narrow tax subsidies, which budget analysts widely call tax expenditures or tax entitlements, because they really represent government spending that's delivered through the tax code. And total tax expenditures are now approaching $1 trillion a year in cost. The budget proposes to narrow these tax subsidies, such as for oil and gas companies, multinational corporations that shift profits abroad to avoid paying their fair share of U.S. taxes, high-income households that receive much bigger subsidies than other Americans for the same tax-deductible expenditures, and the like. Most policymakers and most Americans would agree in principle with the concept of paring back wasteful spending. The reality is that a significant share of the growth in wasteful spending in recent years and decades in the federal budget has come in the form of tax expenditures, spending through the tax code. Over the last decade or two, a cottage industry has grown up in Washington in the face of criticisms of government spending to go extract your subsidies by putting them in the form of tax expenditures or tax breaks and collecting them through the tax code. Some of the most egregious and wasteful tax spending, some of the most egregious and wasteful government spending is found in this category. So the $750 billion over 10 years would come, the majority of it from closing tax expenditures, a smaller amount from reforms of financial institutions such as the fee on banks, and a modest amount through efforts to reduce tax avoidance. Of that $750 billion in tax savings, the president's budget allocates $284 billion for new tax cuts, primarily for middle and lower income families and businesses. Some of them represent interesting policy initiatives. I'll say more in a minute on those. And then the remaining $465 billion out of that $750 billion total would go for deficit reduction. Now, back to my opening point. Enacting the proposals I've just mentioned, whether it's oil and gas, multinational corporations, cap on itemized deductions, fees on the banks, all of these things are going to be very difficult. Given the penchant among some members of Congress to rail against deficits and then vote against most measures to reduce them. As I looked over the budget this morning, I came to the following very sad conclusion. I realized that I thought that it was probably, this is an ironic conclusion for someone like myself who's a bit of a deficit hawk to reach. I found myself concluding that it was actually better that the president had not proposed major additional budget cuts and tax increases, because the additional ones would undoubtedly have been even more politically controversial than the ones already in the budget. And not only would Congress almost certainly have rejected them, but the inevitable sharp attacks on them could have poisoned the well and made these kinds of deficit reduction proposals even harder to achieve in the future if we get to the point where a bipartisan atmosphere makes progress possible. Specifically, I found myself asking myself the following question. In 1982, when President Reagan, with the support of House Speaker Tip O'Neill, set up what became the Greenspan Commission on Social Security, would the country have been well served if either President Reagan or Speaker O'Neill had proposed the benefit and tax changes in Social Security that the Greenspan Commission later recommended? Had they done so at the start of the year, whoever proposed them, the other party and various groups, undoubtedly would have attacked them. They would have met sharp criticism, and they would have been harder for the Greenspan Greenspan Commission to then recommend. So the sad commentary is that our political process, particularly for making hard budget choices, is sufficiently dysfunctional at the present time that if we're going to have a commission this coming year, which I think is no panacea and the odds are against the commission succeeding, but if we're going to have a commission, it would be better to let further proposals try to emerge on a bipartisan basis from the commission rather than to have them thrown up in the air now, shot full of holes, and killed effectively before a commission would begin to deliberate. Moving into some of the basic architecture of the budget, there are three components of it where either in principle or in practice, it gets basic things right. So number one, it sets what we and generally budget analysts across the political spectrum believe is the right target, that it is essential to get to the point where the debt is stable as a share of the economy, where the debt is not growing faster than the economy after the economy is recovered. And to get to that goal, the budget sets the target of reducing the deficit to 3% of the gross domestic product and balancing the primary budget, the budget other than interest payments, by 2015. Those are two different ways of saying the same thing. Interest payments will equal about 3% of GDP in 2015. So a total deficit of 3% of GDP and balancing the budget outside of interest payments are two different ways of saying the same thing. Of course, the budget gets deficits down to about 4% of GDP by 2015, not 3%. The remainder is what the commission is charged with trying to come up with measures to attain. The second point that's reflected in the budget is it repeats the president's commitment to comprehensive health care reform. We continue to believe that that is the single most important next step that policymakers can take to start addressing long-term deficits. There is no question that rising health care costs are the single largest driver in the long-term fiscal imbalance. And one of the undersung, if I could use that word, aspects of the House and Senate health bills is that they do establish an array of research and demonstration projects to identify a new generation of cost containment strategies that could slow cost growth without reducing quality. And they have provisions to allow some of those to be put into effect without having to be enacted by Congress first. Basically, those bills, in our view, create a platform that you could try to build off of for the larger health cost containment steps that are needed in the future. And I really worry if the bill dies, and if it dies in part because of attacks on the Medicare savings provisions in the bill, I worry whether it will be years before we can go back and actually pass something that takes even the first steps to transform the healthcare system, without which no deficit goal can be attained and sustained over time. Finally, the budget, as you know, would allow the Bush-era tax cuts for high-income Americans to expire on schedule at the end of the year. Some members of Congress are already criticizing this, yet as the budget shows, allowing those tax cuts to continue would cost $678 billion plus the associated interest costs. Now, the argument that's being made is the economy is weak. Therefore, one should not allow the tax cuts for people over $250,000 a year to expire. But there's no logical connection between those two statements. If you have the money in the budget, which we don't, but if you did have the money in the budget to continue the tax cuts at the top of the income scale and you were doing it because the economy was weak, then the logical question would be, is that the most effective use of that money to shore up the weak economy? And the answer clearly is no. About a week ago, the Congressional Budget Office issued a paper examining a number of spending and tax options for boosting the economy and creating jobs in the next few years. It looked at about a dozen options, and it rated continuation of the Bush tax cuts for people at the top of the income scale dead last. So the CBO analysis and that of other economists like Mark Zandi suggest that putting resources now into well-designed tax and spending measures that are temporary to boost the economy and create jobs, and letting the high income tax cuts expire on schedule would be more effective than letting those tax cuts continue, both in boosting the economy in the short term and in reducing deficits in the long term. And that's essentially what this budget does. As I noted, it has $266 billion in temporary tax cuts and expenditure increases to help shore up the economy now. It has a number of tax cuts in that $266 billion, like the new hires tax credit the president outlined last week. Virtually all analysts who don't have an ideological axe to grind, like CBO, rate those kinds of tax cuts vastly more effective in creating jobs now while the economy is weak than continuing tax cuts for the top 2% of households who will spend rather than save a large share of those tax reductions. Another element of the president's budget that last week was very controversial was his proposed freeze on non-security discretionary funding. Some criticisms last week argued that would undercut needed support for education, for people who were poor, and the like. Now that the details of the budget are out, it's clear that the budget actually does well in those areas, whether they're education, lower-income Americans, or the like. The budget does indeed increase funding in 2011 over a freeze level in high-priority discretionary areas like education, clean energy, infrastructure, basic science, research and development, child care, and various others, while reducing or terminating funding for various lower priority programs like various projects of the Army Corps of Engineers or NASA's program to return astronauts to the moon. Here, too, there's a question of what happens to the budget when it moves to Capitol Hill. For policymakers to achieve the savings from freezing this part of the budget without impairing the government's ability to meet key needs, Congress is going to have to follow the same practice of reducing funds for low-priority discretionary programs to pay for increases in high-priority ones. Last item I want to mention is one of the third of the 3 points that I started with, where I mentioned there's the short-term economy, there's the long-term fiscal problem, and there's the need for policy reforms, improved policies in various areas. I was struck by the fact that the budget includes some significant reforms and investments that would promote work, increase worker productivity, and boost national savings. I'm referring here to proposals that would strengthen tax credits and programs to help families with child care costs, which would enable some parents to work or to work more, with the strengthened financial assistance so more students can attend college, a more educated workforce being good for the economy in the long run, and the proposals in the budget to boost retirement saving among low and middle income families. And I want to just spend a final minute on the retirement saving proposals. They're quite interesting. The budget has about five interrelated proposals here. It would provide for employers who don't sponsor a retirement plan to automatically enroll their employees in a direct deposit IRA plan. The employees could opt out. It would make it easier for firms that do offer retirement plans to enroll their workers automatically. It would double the tax credit for startup costs for small businesses in setting up a retirement plan, and it would enlarge the tax credit known as the Savers Credit that provides incentives for retirement contributions by low and middle income households. Taken together, these proposals ought to produce a significant increase in retirement saving. And that would both help families, but also help the U.S. economy. It would increase the total amount of national saving, thereby increasing the pool of funds available for new investments in plants and equipment. And the measures I just mentioned, by and large, should attract pretty strong bipartisan support. But here's the rub. The fact that these would be good for families, good for the economy, and have bipartisan support doesn't mean they'll be easy to enact. But why not? Because there's a tax credit, tax cut cost of about $40 billion over 10 years here, and it would have to be paid for. Under the president's budget, it would be paid for by closing some of the tax loopholes I referred to. But if lobbying pressures prevent Congress from having the guts to close the loopholes in order to pay for bipartisan improvements to boost retirement saving, then the retirement saving initiative could fall by the wayside. And that trade-off really reflects the larger dilemma that the budget, that overall U.S. fiscal policy, and indeed the whole U.S. political system now face. It's the question of whether policymakers can set priorities and make the needed hard choices. In our view, this budget represents a promising first step in that direction and will face tough challenges because it does make some choices. And, of course, it's only a first step. Policymakers are going to need to take many more such steps in the not-too-distant future, given the fiscal problems we face. Let me stop there.
This concludes the presentation portion of the briefing from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. You can follow us on Twitter at Center on Budget, find us on Facebook, or create a My Center account at centeronbudget.org.